Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a letter from 10 electors who are expected to vote in a week's time to, as the Constitution dictates, quote, elect a president who is constitutionally qualified and fit to serve, which they sent to the Director of National Intelligence asking for an intelligence briefing on Russia's meddling in the U.S. presidential election. An expert on the Electoral College, Alexander Kaser, a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of the forthcoming book, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College?, joins us to discuss whether, if the evidence of Trump's collusion with Putin is compelling enough, electors could switch to Hillary Clinton. We'll examine the constitutional wiggle room that allows so-called faithless electors to vote their conscience and perhaps follow the advice of Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers to, quote, prevent a desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. Then, with Trump and his spokespeople denying any Russian involvement in the election while leading Republicans call for a bipartisan inquiry into apparent Russian interference, we'll look into how the truth is a moving target in our politics, resulting in he or she who is the best at spinning the truth winning the argument. Frank Pasquale, a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology, joins us. The author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information, will discuss what he calls a, quote, a terrifying duopoly of power, Google and Facebook, and the way Republicans intimidated Facebook into switching their news selection to algorithms, which opened the door to fake news. Then finally, we'll assess the just-announced results of the recount in Wisconsin that confirmed Donald Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton in this key swing state by more than 22,000 votes, resulting in Trump picking up an extra 162 votes. Matthew Rothschild, the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and the former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, joins us to discuss whether the recount was worth it and how much Governor Scott Walker's suppression of Democratic votes affected the outcome. And joining us now is Alexander Kaser, who's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and previously he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections. And his forthcoming book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Kaser.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And an extraordinary, I mean, let's face it, every day something extraordinary has been happening, actually for the last 6 months or so. But I must say it's getting pretty extraordinary now, particularly vis-a-vis this CIA report that suggests that they have high confidence that Vladimir Putin and Russia put their thumbs on the scale in favor of Donald Trump in this last election, and because it's got Donald Trump denying it and all of his people denying it and trashing the CIA. So we're in a moment now where the very notion of reality, fact, is itself up for grabs. Facts have become a moving target. So we're not quite sure about where the dust is going to settle on this matter. But in the midst of this, 10 Electoral College members have requested an intelligence briefing on Russia's meddling in the U.S. presidential election today, which is 1 week before they are scheduled to vote. And it's a bipartisan group, by the way. And they've made their case to the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, in an open letter that was published Monday. What I found extraordinary about the letter was that they cite Alexander Hamilton's writing in the Federalist Papers saying that the Electoral College is charged with preventing, quote, a desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. So on the basis of that, they've got a good case, don't they?
Well, I have actually repeatedly in the last month sort of complained that I think people are exaggerating the importance of Hamilton's Federalist 68, but this particular line does seem very apt. Indeed, what these electors are doing is possibly possibly making the best case for having an electoral college that has been made in about the last 50 or 60 years, that it could serve as a check if something were revealed after the popular election were held. So it's quite extraordinary, you know. And I, like you, have been using the word unprecedented more times over the last 6 months than I would like to think. What's interesting about the elector's letter is that they also ground it in a conception of what their role is, i.e., that they are supposed to deliberate and make decisions, which is indeed quite consistent with what the framers had in mind in writing the Constitution in 1787, and even maybe a little bit less so with the 12th Amendment 15 years later. But it certainly has not been a role that electors have ever really played. By the end of the 18th century, they were simply serving as messengers. So it's an interesting twist in that regard to return to a conception of the elector which has long been obsolete but is there in the Constitution.
Well, can anything be done about the denial on the part of the Trump campaign, going from Trump himself? I mean, the most extraordinary thing happened on Sunday on Fox News, where the State Department number two person, who Donald Trump is apparently about to appoint, John Bolton, he basically denied this Russian hacking and then tried to say that it could be a false flag operation, implying that somehow the Obama administration could be behind this whole thing. That strikes me as being the height of kind of intellectual gymnastics. But you were up there, since you're at Harvard there, you were there for the famous post-election tradition of the campaigns getting together and sort of doing an after-action report. And usually those things are fairly civil and they're all colleagues and in the same business, if you will. But this one was a particularly poisonous and contentious meeting. But at that meeting, was there any mention of the possibility of Russian hacking? I know that Kellyanne Conway went ballistic when it was suggested that Trump enabled the white supremacists in a way, or Bannon did, and that got a lot of the headlines. But was there any discussion about this issue that's now blown up because of the CIA report?
Yes, there was, and it was a most peculiar discussion, or non-discussion as the case may be. Several people from the Clinton campaign, in particular, Robbie Mook, brought up the Russian involvement, the hacking, and how that had been a challenge to the campaign week after week during a crucial period of the campaign. And what I found extraordinary was that the representatives of the Trump campaign, and there were a half dozen, including Kellyanne Conway and David Bossi, and I really, basically all the major figures from the campaign were there. Corey Lewandowski, the former campaign manager, was also there. And I was struck at their systematic rejection of any notion that this Russian involvement might have happened. It was pointed out that 17 intelligence agencies have reached the same conclusion. I don't know if that figure is accurate, but it's the figure that's out there. And they kept saying, nobody knows, we don't know. They're basically the same line that Trump has uttered repeatedly. And what I found extraordinary about it, just as a spectator, as a close-up spectator, I was sitting right there, was that nobody from the Trump campaign said, you know, we're not absolutely certain about this. It's tough to figure out exactly where it came from. But if the Russians were involved with this, it's a serious matter. You know, if they damage the Democrats this time, they could damage us next time. And we will really join you in helping to get to the bottom of this. That would have been a very bland but kind of forthright and encouraging statement. And I did not know why. Nobody said that, why they were so intent. I mean, I have to confess, and this is my speculation, it almost sounded to me as though they were operating in a kind of bad faith, that that they were aware of this and thus couldn't admit it.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Kaser, who's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and previously he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections. And his forthcoming book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? So the 538 members of the Electoral College are going to meet in their state capitals a week from today on December the 19th to cast the only official vote for president. And of course, Donald Trump won the popular vote in the states that included these 306 electors, while Clinton won 232 electors, but of course she's close to 3 million ahead in the popular vote. And Donald Trump has been repeating the extraordinary hyperbole that he won a landslide in the electoral college vote, which he certainly didn't. He came in, I think, on the record, he's 45th out of 54 or something like that. So, again, truth is a moving target. However, my sense, Alexander, is that if you in any way screw with this election, you're just going to have hell to pay. I mean, the people who voted for Donald Trump are sincere. They really believe, many of them, that he is going to deliver them from this corrupt system that has ignored them. The Democratic Party ignored the Rust Belt, which is pretty incomprehensible. And I cannot for the life of me see the point in any way of interfering with this belief on the part of Trump's voters that he's going to deliver him. The only way that they can be let down is by Trump himself. Otherwise, everybody, they'd be screaming, the sabotage, and that the liberal establishment came back to sabotage their hero who was about to deliver his promise to make America great again.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's a sober-minded and savvy assessment of, you know, of the politics of the situation. And it also relates to the kind of fact-free universe that Trump himself and the people around him are in, including, by the way, John Bolton, who has been fact-free for many years, and has always felt free to invent his own facts. But I think, you know, that said, let's suppose for a moment that it's true that the Russians actually did interfere in the election in a way that might have been decisive. If I were an elector, would I just want to say, well, raising that is going to sort of create a partisan mess? Would you really want to say that we should allow this to go forward? Frankly, I mean, I don't think the election of Trump is going to be stopped by this or by anything else. But from the point of view of electors, from the point of view even if one could imagine such a thing as a nonpartisan group of wise lawyers and judges, they might well say, well, if this is a serious possibility, let's really try to look into it before the election is formally ratified.
Well, but let's assume, for example, that it only is going to take 38 of the 306 Trump electors to switch. And if that means if 1 in 8 of Trump's electors switch their votes, Hillary Clinton would therefore be elected president. But
if they switch to Hillary Clinton,
yeah,
which is by no means certain,
right? But this is a hypothetical. That's not the end of it, is it? It doesn't have to go before the House and Senate.
Yes, the electoral votes then go to a joint session of Congress, and are then counted, and in the process of counting, may or may not, the laws are very arcane here, include a judgment about the legitimacy of particular electoral votes. For example, it might, you know, the messiness could really be compounded if, for example, it looked like a dozen or two dozen or more Republican electors were in fact going to cast their ballots elsewhere. If state parties knew this in advance, they might actually try to replace those electors before the votes were cast, or to have alternative slates. And then Congress would have to judge the legitimacy of the different slates.
Well, but if 10 of these people have already made themselves public, have they not, by going to the director of national...
But Attorney. 9 of them are Democrats.
Uh-huh. I see. So just one Republican.
But just one Republican of the 10 letter signers so far.
Right, but there are two Republicans who have come forward and said they can't in good conscience vote for Donald Trump.
Right. No. I mean, I think that there will be a small number of shifting electors, whether it will be, you know, large enough to have an impact, I think is frankly unlikely. But I'm not even sure whether to say the spectacle around this or the raising of these issues is surely unprecedented in its own way, rather frightening.
So we may actually, in this year of anomalies and extraordinary events and out-of-the-box politics, we may even have another anomaly with the Electoral College. There's been, only a handful of so-called faithless electors over the history of the country, but we could have a whole bunch of them for the first time in one election, right?
That's right. I mean, there was a small bunch in 1960 of Southern electors who did not want to vote for John Kennedy. Let me also seize this moment, Ian, to put in a plug for my forthcoming book, which is called Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College?
Well, give us a brief plug on that, because when you ask that rhetorical question, you got a lot of people in the audience saying, yeah, why?
Yes, no, I think, you know, it's both a scholar's question and a question that, you know, tens if not hundreds of millions of people ask every 4 years. There's a three-part short answer. One is that it's difficult to amend the Constitution. Two is that partisanship has played a role in defeating reform efforts, of which there have been hundreds. I mean, 7 times a constitutional amendment has passed one branch of Congress, and on 2 of those occasions it came very close in the other branch. I mean, the Electoral College has been really unpopular for more than 200 years. The third reason, which is very sobering and saddening, is that the politics of race played a very large role from at least the founding until the early 1970s in making reform of the Electoral College exceedingly difficult, if not impossible.
Well, Alexander Kayser, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Kayser, who's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard Kennedy School, where his current research interests includes election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and previously he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections. And his forthcoming book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the terrifying duopoly of power that Google and Facebook represent. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Frank Pasquale, who's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. And he was a visiting fellow at Princeton Center for Information Technology and serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute, Patient Privacy Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And he's the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Pasquale.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
And Frank, let's just go back a little bit to when there was a sort of blitz from the Republicans and various prominent Republicans that suddenly singled out Facebook as being biased in terms of their news. And that, of course, goes along with the recognition that I think about up to two-thirds of Americans get their news from Facebook. So they clearly recognize the enormous influence that Facebook has in terms of disseminating news and aggregating it. So that seemed to me to be a fairly political move and, in fact, a very smart move on their part, because they basically, the Republicans argued that Facebook was biased, and then they managed to get Facebook to abandon their human curation of the news and go to algorithms, which then the Republicans, particularly Steve Bannon and company, and perhaps with the help of Peter Thiel, were able to, you know, manipulate these or penetrate these algorithms or capture them to plant fake news to the detriment of Hillary Clinton and to the benefit of Donald Trump. Is that an accurate summary of what happened?
I think that there are at present a lot of unknowns, although I would say that given what we do know, the narrative you just presented is a perfectly plausible one. Because, first of all, the initial story about the bias against conservatives was a very thinly sourced story. And it probably would have been relatively easy for Facebook to just say, look, you know, this is like one random incident one time, and, you know, we're going to be more transparent about the way that we have this newsfeed done, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, given the extreme irresponsibility of Facebook in terms of its just sudden decision to go, say, all algorithm all the time, yeah, that raises a lot of questions, and it certainly, you know, would be compatible with a narrative where there was this plan or plot, you know, there. I also want to say, though, that there are other narratives that are potentially would make sense of the same series of events, one being that Facebook is notoriously dismissive of the talents of people who are not coders or engineers. So there's a good book by Kate Lossa, who is a speechwriter for Zuckerberg, who I think was stuck at the same salary, like below $40,000 or $35,000 a year for years, despite the fact that, you know, she was doing all this great work in terms of just writing and presenting the public face of the company. And, you know, and those stories are legion at Facebook. And so it doesn't surprise me that, you know, the response to a scandal about the or a contrived or whatever you want to describe the scandal about suppression of conservative news, that their response would be just to say, oh, we're getting rid of the human element, and we're just going to try to do this all by machine learning and artificial intelligence.
So given that Peter Thiel, the libertarian billionaire Silicon Valley character who spoke at the Republican convention and brought down an internet company, sued them, put them out of business, which, you know, does certainly give people in the press a little bit of pause, but nevertheless, he is somebody that seems to be a fairly active player in the Trump campaign, and he's on the board of Facebook. Do you think in any way he played a role in this moving away from human curation of news on Facebook to algorithms, which then enabled the Republicans to plant fake news?
Well, I would say that in terms of the fake news, I would first, just in terms of some of the premises of the question, just to clarify a bit, I think it is likely true that there are these fake news outlets that have more success with inflaming or otherwise sort of activating a conservative base. And I think that conservative base, just to follow on some of the work of like the media studies scholar Daniel Kreiss, that conservative base has sort of been, I think, primed for that type of activation by media outlets like Fox, you know, others, the Wall Street Journal, I would include in that the editorial page, et cetera. They've been primed for that for, you know, over a decade, at least, by Murdoch-type publications, Roger Ailes-type publications, et cetera. And so it's not necessarily the case that you would need to have any formal coordination with the Republican Party or the Trump campaign for an epidemic of, you know, fake news to really have an effect, you know, in certain ways of activating people. In terms of Thiel's own, you know, involvement with that decision, I would not know. I don't know exactly how involved a board member he is, et cetera. It seems as though that board is pretty tight-knit, and it seems as though also one of the things that was recently in the news is that the board was, or that people were worried that Mark Zuckerberg might himself run for office. That also is something that has been in the news lately. So I don't know. I mean, I do think it is interesting that, you know, someone like Thiel would make such a big bet on Trump. And I would not be surprised in the least if proprietary data from Facebook or other internet companies, including his own, you know, Palantir, which, you know, has an incredible sort of ability to spy and to understand what's going on online, that some sort of data like that could have led folks to have access to it, to have a better understanding of the electorate than perhaps a lot of pollsters did.
And Thiel's company, Palantir, does a lot of work for the CIA, does it not?
Yes, yes. And also his, you know, investment firms, et cetera, have lots of Defense Department contracts. Long blog post before the election about certain disputes that they were in with the Defense Department, et cetera. So, yeah, behind the veneer of like a free market libertarian Silicon Valley are incredibly deep connections to the deep state, yes.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Pasquale. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. And he was a visiting fellow at Princeton's Center for Information Technology and serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute, Patient Privacy Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and is the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. Now, when we talk about Palantir's relation to the CIA, of course, it brings up the extraordinary irony of the situation we're in now, where Donald Trump is basically saying that he's right, he's smart, and the CIA is not. They're incompetent. They got weapons of mass destruction wrong in Iraq. He doesn't need to take intelligence briefings. And he's dismissing out of hand the CIA consensus that they have a high degree of confidence that Russia has been involved in tipping the scales in the recent elections in Donald Trump's favor. So I guess your point's well taken. You know, when you talk about fake news, what is the difference between a lot of stuff that's on Breitbart and certainly almost everything that Alex Jones says? And Alex Jones, of course, is somebody that Donald Trump appears to admire.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think this fake news issue is a real one. And I want to say that, you know, with respect to Trump and the CIA and the rest, you know, I mean, this is, it reminds me of that old interview that Ron Suskin did. And I think this person turned out to be Karl Rove, where he was talking with the Bush administration folks and someone who I think was Rove said, you know, you are going to spend all your time trying to figure out what we're doing and why we're doing it, et cetera. You know, you members of the reality-based community. But we create our own reality, you know, and so it doesn't really matter to us what you think of what we do, et cetera. I think we're really seeing that on steroids with Trump. I mean, I think that you see in particular, you know, with the just he makes statements on all sides of all issues. I mean, even Fox News will call him on that. And, you know, at one moment he'll say that the CIA is full of, you know, doesn't know what they're doing. And then the next, you know, that they're the vital intelligence asset that supports something that he wants to do. You know, and it reminds me of Harry Frankfurt's book. I mean, I can't say it on the radio, but it's about, you know, behavior where someone just, you know, it's not even like the person is lying. It's just that they're talking in a way that's not really about conveying information. It's a talking in an emotional way to convey a certain attitude, but not really to convey any information. And I think that, you know, that is a big part of the fake news phenomenon as well, is that, you know, they can, let's say that the Alex Jones, let's say if Hillary Clinton were to sue Alex Jones for defamation for saying that she had murdered and cooked children, right? I mean, I think he said something along those lines, or someone, you know, online said something along those lines. He would probably say, oh, well, you know, if this ever came to court, he'd say, well, oh, obviously I was, you know, this was hyperbole, or it was a, you know, a performance art, or it was something else. And I think that's where, you know, our society is really in deep trouble, because we have a whole bunch of people sending out dishonest signals or strange, you know, words that they don't have to own up to, and the words have lost their meaning.
Well, but in an era when newspapers are going out of business and television networks are essentially going out of business somewhat more slowly, and people get more of their information now on Facebook than anywhere else, and much of it is basically aggregating like the Huffington Post does. So there's a whole shift going on in the media, and in particularly in news and information. And then when you add that into the general growth of activity in social media, where so much is said by so many about so little, isn't that a kind of the situation we're in here that leads people like the woman that worked on the Trump campaign to say that reality doesn't matter anymore?
Yes, I heard that interview. And yes, that's exactly, I was shocked to hear that as well, when basically there was the idea almost seemed to be that as long as a significant number of people believe something, that it was therefore important, and that it was just as open or all right for politicians to take advantage of that ignorance and to try to work it up into a frenzy as it was for them to try to correct it. And that is a terrifying situation, you know, and I think it really is sort of when Hannah Arendt wrote The Origins of Totalitarianism, she sort of saw similar, you know, types of disregard for truth in the beginnings of totalitarian regimes. Yeah.
Well, Stephen Bannon, of course, the head of Breitbart News, who Donald Trump has appointed as his chief strategist, he's on the board of Cambridge Analytica. And Cambridge Analytica is an American-owned company based in London, which was employed both by the Brexit Leave campaign and by the Trump campaign. And Cambridge Analytica targets individuals through data mining on social media, etc. So that seems to me to be taking it further. In other words, it's not just that we have this phenomenon that so much that Google and these other monopolies like Facebook, or these duopolies of power, as you call them, Frank Pasquale, and you in doing so, you're calling for algorithmic accountability. The point here that I wanted to make was, is there more to this than just the challenge that this new landscape in the media presents to us, on top of which, is it possible that Trump and Bannon are much more proactive than, say, the Democrats are?
Yes, I mean, I think that the use of data here is very troubling. I don't necessarily think that the Republicans had a huge data advantage in this election. I think that, you know, in fact, some of the they may have used it more skillfully. But the biggest problem, I think, and this gets to our earlier conversation about truth, is that you see the weaponization of personalization. So you can have these personalized appeals to people. In one campaign, you know, they might have something that they're going to do for the elderly and healthcare, but they maybe also be planning to get rid of Medicare. Well, they can find everyone that's over 65 and just advertise the one little nice thing they're going to do for them. You know, maybe it's like free membership in the Silver Sneakers gym program or something. But then, you know, meanwhile, they can advertise to everybody else, we're going to cut your taxes and, you know, be plotting to destroy Medicare. And that, I think, is very troubling. You know, it's very, very troubling to be in a system. And ultimately, you know, as there's more and more research, can be done within these companies to figure out, you know, what are people interested in? What are they not interested in? What are they talking about? What did they vote? Who did they vote for? Who are they talking about in their emails that they voted for, et cetera? All of that can be put together, and it's going to be so much deeper and more personalized knowledge than a pollster could ever get. And, you know, I think this might also have been the last year where we really think of the pollsters as having the best insights into the electorate. Really, at this point, from now on, it's going to be firms like Cambridge Analytica and then the big mega firms in Silicon Valley that are really going to have the insights. And that brings tremendous political power.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Pasquale. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. And he was a visiting fellow at Princeton's Center for Information Technology and serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute, Patient Privacy Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and is the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. So pretty much what the Cambridge Analytica did then for the Brexit Leave campaign and the Trump campaign is how you described it, right? That this is really the next generation, if you will, of pollsting, far more deep, far more accurate, and far more personal.
That's right, yes. And because it's so personalized, they can really be all things to all people. You know, it's sort of the dream come true where you don't have one big speech to everybody. You know, and that's where I think also Trump's campaign was quite smart in the sense that, you know, you had Hillary Clinton putting out detailed proposals that could be picked apart, and there were winners and obvious winners and losers to the proposal. If you run a campaign where you're saying everything on all different sides, where your candidate is doing that, but meanwhile in the background you've got a data analytics team that is micro-targeting little ads to people, you know, whom they, to every steel worker, you know, or every auto worker saying, we're going to change trade policy to bring back the manufacturing jobs, you know, that's a much savvier campaign than to sort of actually run a campaign where you're giving the details on what you're going to do.
Well, of course, the BBC documentarian, Adam Curtis, are you familiar with his work?
Oh, I love his work, yes.
Well, his latest work is really about this subject matter and how Putin and Putin's advisors, Surkov in particular, devised this very methodology of governance through propaganda where you do put out conflicting information all the time, cover all sides, and keep people continually off balance. And he makes the case in his latest documentary that what Putin has achieved in Russia, Trump and Bannon may well transport here to the United States.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that there's going to be a lot of watching as to what, you know, and I do think that, you know, the brutality of the Russian regime with respect to protesters and dissent is something to behold. But on the other hand, it's not necessarily, that level of brutality probably is not needed in a state country like the U.S. where our electoral rules are so biased in certain ways and are likely to become even more biased over the coming next few years. So, yeah, I do think that is a real worry.
But Adam Curtis's thesis about the growth of hyper-normalization, as he calls it, I mean, I think we're in the era of hyper-normalization. I mean, everything. I pick up the paper every day. I go, if you watch cable news, all you hear is this back and forth about CIA says that Trump, you know, was helped by Putin, and Putin says the opposite. I mean, then Trump says the opposite, and then Putin says the opposite, and it's just like truth is a moving target, and it's really a question of he who spins the truth the more skillfully wins the argument.
I think that's right, and I think that, you know, that's one a situation where it reminds me of a debate that actually during the George W. Bush administration, where between Cass Sunstein and George Lakoff, and I think you could think of Cass Sunstein as the paradigmatic neoliberal enlightenment rationalist behaviorist economist type of person that sort of believed that everything had to be the way that to win political arguments was to make a very rational case for the benefits of your proposal and why it has fewer costs than others, et cetera. And George Lakoff just pointed out, I think brilliantly at that point, that no, there are very deep emotional, intuitive centers that, you know, help shape political identity. And, you know, I think that is a real key here and something that both the Brexit campaign and the Trump campaign understood extremely well. You know. And for there to be any sizable and substantial and successful resistance to policy changes like that, the people who want different policies have to realize that it's, you know, the public sphere in politics is not a debating society. It's not a place where people are, you know, totting up points and fact checkers can instantly discredit someone's statements, right? And we've learned that sort of once and for all. And it's scary, you know, and it's particularly scary for a lot of the people that, you know, are in academia or in the media or other places where, you know, traditionally truth has been seen as the highest value. But it is something that, you know, is I think an undeniable consequence and, you know, of the politics of 2016.
Well, when you say scary, though, there's nothing scarier than this Pizzagate situation where, and in fact, General Flynn, the National Security Advisor's own son, was one of the people that was promoting this conspiracy theory on social media that prompted a young man from North Carolina to go up to Washington with several firearms and fire an assault rifle in a pizza place because he honestly believed that pizza place was a front for a child sex ring being operated by Hillary Clinton. You know, if you wrote a movie script like that, they'd throw you out of Hollywood. But nevertheless, it happened. It's a fact. And, you know, my sense is that the opposition to Trump, which is considerable now, as you know, 3 million more people voted for the other person. What can be done in this environment? Because the people who voted for Donald Trump are deeply invested. They have a heartfelt belief that this man is going to deliver them and deliver the country away from these corrupt politicians who've run it into the ground. And he is going to make America great again. And the last thing that can happen is for them to be given an excuse that somehow the liberal establishment sabotaged Donald Trump. Don't you think we're at a point now where Donald Trump has to go ahead and ruin America on his own in order to make the people who voted for him realize they got had?
I want to talk first about Pizzagate, then I'll come to the theory of political change that you were discussing. I think with respect to Pizzagate, that is clearly terrifying. And that's something where, you know, we need very active interventions by the people running these social networks like Twitter and Facebook to just stomp it out. You know, just to, you know, when you see these sort of hashtags and you see this sort of like viral spread of something that is that disgusting and obviously untrue and baseless, realize that what that is essentially is what's often called stochastic terrorism, which is to say that you put something out there knowing that some mentally disturbed or mentally ill individual or someone who is, you know, prone to violence, that's a better characterization, is going to seize on it and do something terrible, right? And you know that that's going to happen. And you know, now we've seen it happen both with Joe Cox, I think, in Britain, and with the Pizzagate scenario, which fortunately was not that severe as the actual assassination of an MP. But I think in both of those cases, you know, where a lot of the hate speech and other things that go out there really have to be monitored closely. And, you know, that's on the platforms. And Dick Costolo, the former CEO of Twitter himself, has acknowledged that. And it's interesting to see that even it's even hit the share price of Twitter in the sense that people don't want to buy it. Disney didn't want to buy it. And other companies don't want to buy it because they realize it is an absolute sort of it's infested with a lot of the most reckless and damaging types of expression and really manipulation imaginable. To come to your point about the, you know, the people being betrayed by Trump, my big worry here is that essentially there whatever happens bad is going to get blamed on the prior administration. You know, that's going to be the propaganda effort. And then we're back to our earlier discussion, which was, you know, about the how what happens in a world in which there's just no sort of common ground of agreement. And, you know, I'm pretty pessimistic. And I do think that there are the one thing that I think could help a lot would be an opposition that has a relatively straightforward and clear message. And after the election, relatively right after the election, I wrote up a postmortem of the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, saying this was always far too complicated to be politically defensible, right? It may well be the highest thoughts, processes, or the most sophisticated analysis by the health technocrats, but it could not be sold by a politician on the stump. And what you need is a Democratic Party that's willing to say things like, we are going to give everybody health care. You know, everyone's going to have health care, or everyone is going to have free college education, et cetera. and we're going to find a way to pay for it, you know, and then giving and offering a account of how you're going to pay for it that's exactly as detailed and as realistic as Trump's account of how he was going to pay for what he's doing, right? That's the bottom line. If you have one party that is sort of offering the hard and bitter truth at all times, you know, constrained by the what are often themselves made-up rules of people like the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, et cetera. If you have one party doing that, and you have the other party that sort of really taps into individuals' aspirations, hopes, dreams, et cetera, I can tell you from the get-go who's going to win. So I think that, you know, it's not just going to be a matter of, you know, what's the performance of the economy under the Trump administration and people voting on the basis of that. They've got to have something to vote for. And that's, you know, it's quite up in the air, I think, as to whether they'll actually have that by 2018 or 2020.
Well, indeed, and they certainly didn't have it in this last election. You always knew what Donald Trump stood for. He's going to build a wall and make America great again. You never knew exactly what Hillary Clinton stood for, and the Democrats clearly paid for it. I thank you for joining us, Frank Pasquale.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be on the program. Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much. And again, I've been speaking with Frank Pasquale. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland. His research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. He was a visiting fellow at Princeton Center for Information Technology and serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute and Privacy, Patient Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And he's the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with the just-announced results of the recount in Wisconsin.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matthew Rothschild, who's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. He is a former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin, and one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country, and the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
Thanks, Ian, for having me on.
And it does feel that there's quite a likelihood that we're going to be heading into a new age of repression in the United States with Steve Bannon and an authoritarian president, Donald Trump. Do you feel like you're going to have to update your book?
Yeah, I could write a whole new book. I mean, I've been using the F word pretty frequently these days because I do think Donald Trump looks like and acts like and quacks like a fascist. And I think we need to prepare ourselves for the worst here and start organizing right now, as we are in Wisconsin, and I'm sure people are elsewhere, for some united fronts to confront Trump and Trumpism and to prepare right away in every case to help the most vulnerable among us, whether that means sanctuary cities, sanctuary places of worship, or new underground railroad if Trump starts coming for Muslim Americans or Latinos or immigrants of any variety. I mean, we need to be able to reach out and help people who are going to be in his crosshairs.
So we learned today in Madison, Wisconsin, that the Wisconsin Election Commission certified the recount that in Wisconsin that was initiated by Green Party candidate Jill Stein and paid for and by her campaign And apparently the results are pretty much that it hasn't changed, and that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by more than 22,000 votes in the state. And in this recount, the net result is that Donald Trump picked up a net of 162 extra votes as a result of the recount. So how does that strike you?
Well, it makes sense to me. I didn't think Hillary Clinton was going to win Wisconsin on the recount. I'm glad there was a recount, though. I'm always glad that we are able to monitor the elections and the ballots to make sure everything is kosher and that there wasn't some hanky-panky going on. So I'm glad the recount happened. I'm not surprised by the results. Look at Hillary Clinton never came to Wisconsin. And what people forget is she lost 71 out of 72 counties to Bernie Sanders. She only won one county here. And if I had lost so many counties in Wisconsin, which she needed to win, I would have made sure that I brought my campaign here and brought myself here. And she also just ran a lousy campaign all over the place. I mean, she was wasting time and money in Texas and Arizona. She spent a gajillion dollars in Ohio and in Iowa, which seemed lost for a long time. And she barely campaigned at all with advertising in Michigan or in Wisconsin. So, plus, she had no message. And she didn't put Bernie on the ticket like she should have. She scorned Bernie Sanders and the Sanders supporters. The DNC rigged the campaign against Bernie. And, you know, take a bow, Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Well, it you can write a long book about what a lousy campaign Hillary Clinton ran, and you could also have a prelude to that book, which was the 2008 campaign. So it is a peculiarity that somebody that is qualified would have this fatal flaw of running lousy campaigns and presumably picking bad people, which is not doesn't augur well for somebody that would pick a White House administration. Not that Donald Trump is picking people that were in any way happy about.
No, the Donald Trump cabinet is a horror show, to be sure. But, you know, Hillary Clinton, the first pick she made was Tim Kaine. What did he do for that campaign? I think she was going to win Virginia anyway. And he didn't excite a single voter. Bernie Sanders would have excited millions of voters and would have unified the party and appealed to independents. So, and would have appealed to those blue-collar Democrats who turned out and voted for Trump. And there were a lot of those here in Wisconsin who voted for Trump, who had voted for Obama before.
And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and the former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. So Jill Stein, of course, has also tried to get recounts in Pennsylvania and in Michigan, both of which have been blocked by the courts. The fact that the Trump campaign stepped in and blocked these recounts strikes me as, you know, almost an admission of guilt. What's your sense of that? I mean, obviously, the results in Wisconsin made no difference. In fact, Trump picked up 162 votes. But do you think she was right in pursuing them? And what's your sense of of the motives in blocking a recount?
Well, I think Jill Stein was right in asking for recounts. When elections are close, it's good to verify the results. And there's been all sorts of questions raised about the voting machines, the voting process, whether some hanky-panky was going on or some monkey business was going on. So let's have those recounts and, you know, allay those fears, or find out that they were well-founded. Now, I understand why the Trump campaign wouldn't want recounts anywhere. I don't think it's an admission of guilt. I just think, you know, they're trying to protect what they have, and they don't want any possibility of things going wrong once they've won. And so I just think they were, you know, wearing suspenders and a belt at the same time. They were just being extra careful.
So do you think, though, that in general Scott Walker has been very effective in restricting the vote in Wisconsin with these new voter IDs? I mean, given that you're absolutely correct in the broader contextual point, that Hillary Clinton ran a lousy campaign and didn't even campaign in Wisconsin, and Bernie Sanders won, what, 76 out of 74 counties or something, you told us.
Yeah, 71 out of 72.
71 out of 72, and that should have been a signal to her that maybe at the very least she should have sent Bernie out there, let alone put him on the ticket with her. And many people, of course, argue that had Bernie Sanders run instead of Hillary Clinton, he would have beaten Donald Trump. But let's just deal with the behind-the-scenes efforts of Scott Walker and whether they did make a difference in depressing the Democratic vote.
I do think they made a difference. They made it harder for people to register to vote and harder for people to vote on Election Day. And so that suppressed some of the vote. A few people who went to vote who should have been allowed to vote weren't allowed to vote, and that's horrible. It didn't tip the balance, but it's horrible. But there also was a bit of dampening of the interest among people to go vote because there was so much confusion about what was necessary. I mean, the law kept changing. Walker and his wrecking crew kept putting up more and more hurdles on the way to the voting booth. Then judges would come in and change what Walker was trying to do, to my mind, for the better, but it caused a lot of confusion. And the sowing of confusion created, in a sense, some apathy among some voters who just kind of threw up their arms and said, it's too complicated. I don't know what ID I need to get. Just forget about it. I'm not going to go. I don't like either candidate anyhow.
So what's your sense then of just in closing, Matthew Rothschild, of what the Democratic Party can do to, and they've only got 2 years before their next election, and frankly, I think, you know, the people who lost this election ought to be not thinking about, you know, recounts and what could have, you know, what conspiracy theories may be involved, and not to mention the Russians. But mainly, they should be focusing on winning the next one, surely. And they got 2 years to get their act together. And what do you think the chances of that are?
Well, I think they need to get Keith Ellison to run the Democratic National Committee. I think they have a real message problem. They need to get their message together as to what the Democratic Party stands for and what it can do for you and me and your listeners' relatives, instead of, you know, I'm with her. I mean, what is she going to do for me? That's what people wanted to know. And what are the three things the Democratic Party is going to do for people concretely? Otherwise, they're just blowing smoke.
Well, Matthew Rothschild, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Project and the former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.